It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, it's home-roasted coffee, perhaps the ultimate and most satisfying DIY. And one of the cult figures is Tom Owen. He's got the Sweet Maria's coffee site.
You basically just have to tend to it, especially in the last 30 seconds or so, because it turns from green to a golden yellow to a light brown, darker brown, and then you hear the first crack, which is a popping sound, like popcorn, but a little more subtle. And anything from first crack on is ready, depending on your taste. French roast is left in longer in the heat source, and what we call city roast or light roast is right after that first crack or first pop ends.
Tom Owen of Sweet Maria's. Stick around. There's more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, I don't know about you, but I've been in low gear all week. I could barely turn the oven on to 325. So I decided to think of it as one big slow roaster. Well, it turns out a lot of people are thinking the same way right now. I mean, you say easy one-pot meal and visions of crockpots and starting tonight's dinner while you're eating your granola at 7 a.m. this morning come to mind. Well, to clue us in with some fresh new ideas, we turn to PBS chef Ming Tsai. He's the champ of East-West cooking, and he joins us with his book, Simply Ming, One-Pot Meals. Ming, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Great to be here.
You know, I have to smile to myself because, of course, your go-to one pot is the wok. Mine is a 12-inch sauté pan. But the thing that I realized reading this book is people don't realize what they can do with a wok.
Right. You can do a lot.
Give us some thoughts.
Well, obviously you stir fry. And the concept of the wok being concave, right, nice and curved, is you don't need as much oil to cover the surface. And then when you move your food around, it always ends up touching oil, so you don't need to add as much. So that's one reason why wok cooking is so good and healthier. But if you fill it with water, and I always, one of my tips is actually add a pinch of tea leaves to flavor the water, because sometimes water has an off flavor, then it's a steamer. Take one of those bamboo steamers and put it on top. It's a wonderful pot to use to steam, as well because of the great surface area, because it's obviously much bigger towards the top. When you boil pasta, you can use a wok. You know, the Italian ratio and the Chinese as well, you want at least five times water to the amount of pasta you're boiling. You can absolutely achieve that with a wok. The last thing my parents used to do it all the time, it's a wonderful pot for frying. You don't need, again, as much oil because it's so concave towards the bottom. You can fill, you know, just a few inches of oil and fry spring rolls or wontons.
Yeah. What are some of the one-dish meals that you do in it?
Well, there's some classic stir fries. There's a pork kimchi with noodle stir fry. There's a green peppercorn beef with asparagus, and that actually uses rotini pasta, which is not a Chinese noodle. That's an Italian one. I love my take on a gungbao chicken with rice. So that's the peanuts with chicken that has carrots and celery and onions. So those are some classic stir fries. But then we use the wok to do what I call flashing. I steam fish. And then an old Chinese technique is you flash whole fish with oil to add lusciousness and nice kind of silkiness to the fish.
Why don't you explain what flashing actually is?
Well, flashing traditionally, and Nobu Matsuhisa, who's a great friend, he's completely popularized it with the Japanese technique he calls new style sashimi. So he takes raw fish and flashes it with a hot olive oil. So it kind of partially cooks the fish. I call it sashimi 101. But in Chinese cuisine, which would predate this technique, we would always steam a whole fish, traditionally with a little soy, ginger, and scallion. At the end, right before serving, you'd flash it with hot peanut oil. And again, it would add a lusciousness and richness to the dish, and it actually almost forms its own sauce as it goes through the fish onto the platter. It's just a wonderful way of eating fish, and the fish flavor really shines through, which is the key.
So you would take the fish out, you would empty out the hot water, and then you'd dry the wok, and then you'd quickly heat oil in it, and that a little bit of that would be spooned over the fish? That's
exactly.
The flashing.
You basically heat the oil until it's just starting to smoke.
Ah.
And then you take a tablespoon, you know, stainless steel spoon, and then you just literally flash it on, and you'll hear a little sizzle because it's cooking it a little bit more. And exactly, it's just it adds that richness that I find luscious. And again, you're adding so little fat, but you're adding so much flavor.
Yeah,
so it's a must do.
I think a lot of people are gun shy about steaming, and they don't realize how great it can be, how simple it is.
Oh God, it's a wonderful technique. And regardless that the fact that it's really healthy, it's a great way to keep certain meats and proteins and fish moist. It's great for vegetables too, but again, you need flavor. So make sure there's garlic and ginger, or soy, or sesame oil. You can't just if you steam broccoli and that's all you're doing, it's going to taste like mushy broccoli. So you need to do better than that. But by adding flavor and seasoning, it can be delicious.
It can be fabulous. You know, let's talk about making soup in a wok. How do you like to do that?
Well, by the way, for those that don't own a wok, you can absolutely do all the wok dishes in a large sauté pan as long as the volume of the pan is big enough. But if you do have a wok or have the hankering, we'll definitely get a good flat-bottom wok because no one has a stove at home that's big enough BTU-wise, enough heat for the round one. The round ones are great for restaurants.
Right.
A flat-bottom is just better for a home cook. But because of its shape again, to make a classic soup, you usually saute all your aromatics. It could be garlic, onions, ginger, whatever. If there's meat in the soup, you would saute that. You would then usually deglaze with a wine or a Shaoxing or some type of alcohol if you
and
like
Shaoxing
alcohol.
And Shaoxing is Chinese rice wine, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. It tastes kind of like sherry. And then you add your stock. And then you bring it to a simmer and you let it simmer. And again, because the top of the wok has great surface area, it can reduce quickly for you.
Right. Yeah, and you cook much faster. And I think the thing, too, is you can make minestrone. It doesn't have to be an Asian recipe.
Right.
You do a one-pot spaghetti or pasta and meatballs with an Asian touch. Talk about how you do that.
My take on East-West cuisine is really getting as much flavor into the protein or into what you're making.
Right,
and right. I kind of just took the classic meatball. And instead of, you know, of course, there's different schools of thought, but it's either veal pork or veal pork beef or whatever school you may be from. I use ground chicken. But
that's super lean.
It is, but you get to add fat because I have olive oil that has tons of onions. And onions, of course, has flavor and moisture with garlic.
Right.
And I use panko as a breadcrumb because you need something in a meatball to make it light. You can't just have 100% meat. And I always recommend use dark chicken, which has so much more flavor than, of course, chicken breast, white chicken. And by the way, there's new research now through something called angiogenesis that actually dark chicken is better for you than white chicken, which I'm elated, as all my chef friends are, to hear about that. Dark chicken, as long as it's cooked just right, is incredibly moist and flavorful. It does not have to be dry.
Sounds great. Hey, Ming, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Ming Tsai's book is Simply Ming, One Pot Meals. Now, if you want to try pork kimchi with noodles, the recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, you can find kimchi in a lot of supermarkets now, but if you can get to a Korean market, you're going to see that kimchi isn't only cabbage. Kimchi is a generic term for a couple of hundred different preserved vegetables. And here's the thing about kimchi. You could use it the way Ming does in his pork noodle dish, that is, as an ingredient and the flavoring of a recipe. But I think it could be an ace in the hole for fast suppers, and interesting ones, too. Let me explain. Whenever I've had Korean food, the first thing that shows up on the table are many small dishes of different kinds of kimchi, like radishes with ginger and spices, or spinach with chilies and garlic, and so on. Then the main dish is put down, and you eat it with bits of the vegetables. Well, here's the thing. I don't think you need that main dish. I mean, at home, if you've got a bowl of cooked barley or grain or rice or noodles, you could have all different kinds of kimchi and just take a taste here and a taste there. Make dinner whatever you want it to be. And talk about healthy. Now, if you want to try making your own kimchi, there's a starter recipe on the website. It's cabbage kimchi, and you're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Healthy is good. So is a great Chicago hot dog or Mississippi fried catfish or a Philly cheesesteak. Now, this is the kind of local hometown food that's mother's milk to Jane and Michael Stern. They report their finds on their road food site and here. So Jane, Michael, welcome back. What is the latest?
We have been thinking about that grand old tradition of tea room dining in America. You know, there was a time back in the 20s and 30s when tea rooms were really popular, both in cities and along highways in this country. There are so few of them left.
And I think by tea room dining, what Michael's referring to is kind of ladies' lunch. I mean, places that ladies wearing hats and veils would go to, and they'd have lovely little dishes of Jell-O salad with chicken salad on the side and sort of lady food. Yeah. I don't know if we have any ladies left, but if we do, that is where they should eat.
There actually used to be one of these places not so long ago in New York City called Mary Elizabeth's, and it was sort of the last of the ones in New York City. But there is one in Atlanta called Mary Mac's Tea Room. It opened in 1945, and it is virtually unchanged. I mean, it's been redecorated and it's very modern looking, but the menu is a trip back in time to that kind of wonderful ladies' lunch kind of eating where everything is very pretty and lovely and presented in moderate-sized portions and served with grace and charm by uniformed waitresses.
Yeah, and speaking about going back in time, Michael, we found Mary Mac's Tea Room on our very first road food trip in 1970, blah, blah, blah.
Really?
I mean, it was probably the first Southern tea room that we ever ate in. And we just went back there a month ago, and it was every bit as wonderful as we remember it.
I remember early on, one of the things that impressed us so much about it was we were looking for regional dishes. And we found – this was one of the few places we found that still serves pot liquor, you know, which is the broth retrieved from the pot when you cook greens. You can get just a bowl of pot liquor with cornbread on the side. You crumble the cornbread on top of the pot liquor, and you've got a real vegetable – essence of vegetable lunch.
I think this is the Southern version of chicken soup, a.k.a. Jewish penicillin,
because we're
down south and Michael isn't feeling quite well. He always claims that pot liquor has cured him.
But what else is on the menu? I mean, is it the dainty salads and things in little scoops? Is that the kind of
thing? There are dainty salads. There's some not so dainty but very wonderful fried chicken. The main thing you want to get on this menu is vegetables. You know, the Deep South is just so into vegetables. There are probably 2 dozen different vegetables on the menu. I'm talking about yams. I'm talking about those greens. I'm talking about Hoppin' John and crisp fried okra and some of the best, my favorite Southern vegetable, macaroni and cheese you'll ever have.
Right. I didn't know that was a vegetable, but now that you mention it, sure. Maybe
it's yam souffle, not just yams.
So is this a very sort of fancy place?
No. It's very informal. It's polite and it's kind of neat and tidy, and I believe the tables may have cloths on them. I can't quite remember, but it's not in the least bit diner-like, but it's very informal. People go there on a lunch hour, and you can easily have a wonderful lunch for well under $10.
And I do have to say that if I had to make a list of the top 5 fried chicken places in the South, Mary Mac's would be on that list.
It's great.
They have a way with making the crispest skin and the juiciest inside. It is fabulous.
Well, thank you, guys.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind roadfood.com. Now, you can track their latest restaurant picks on the website, splendidtable.org. We'll be back in a moment with home coffee roasting advice and the last word on cooking pasta from food scientist Harold McGee. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Okay, I'm ready now.
Don't kid yourself that the DIY craze is solely about saving money. It's about control issues, and it's also about the fun of figuring stuff out. Now, along with the Home Repair Gang, there's a league of coffee lovers. They insist the only coffee worth drinking is the one where you've roasted the beans all by your lonesome. Well, one of their cult figures is Tom Owen. He's an early arrival on the Roast Your Own scene. He's got the Sweet Maria's coffee site. Tom, welcome.
Good to be here.
Tom, I want to talk about home coffee roasting. If we want to just give it a shot, you know, not make any kind of major investment, is there a way to get into it to try it out?
Well, that's a funny question because it's definitely something for fanatics. So this very reasonable approach you have almost doesn't gel with the kind of people out there that roast their own coffee. They tend to just go for it.
But you know, this is where, do I want to become a fanatic or do I not want to become a fanatic?
Right. And that's so reasonable. Because the amazing thing about home roasting is it's not home beer brewing or winemaking. It's actually really a lot easier, and you can try it out for next to nothing. The best way is the hot air popcorn popper. Do you remember those?
Oh, yeah.
It's a great coffee roaster.
Huh.
Yeah. So now they're a little hard to find now. The home hot air popcorn popping craze is, I guess, kind of over. But there's a few drug stores you can still find them in new.
Mm-hmm.
And thrift stores are fantastic for these things. You want the kind, if you see, go to a thrift store and you get one, look down into that cylinder.
Yeah.
And if it's a flat metal bottom and it has vents around the edge that would swirl the popcorn or coffee
right,
around.
Right, because hot air comes through there.
Exactly. That's the best kind. The old models, it's the West Bend Popery 2 is one you might see a lot of, and it's a great coffee roaster. And then there's the holy grail of all popcorn popper coffee roasters is they call it the Popery Mark 1. It just says Popery on it. And you'll pick this one up, and you'll notice it's three times as heavy as all the other ones.
And this is the one you want.
And three times as ugly, too, by the way.
Okay.
But you can have a small business for yourself going to thrift stores, buy these for $2. And on eBay, they go for $30, $50, $60.
This is great to know. This can become a home business.
You can have a business and roast coffee. Yeah.
So, all right. Now I've got the popper, right? I plug it in. I have to have beans that are green, right? Unroasted beans.
And raw green coffee. Yeah.
Okay.
And you just add it until you see it basically stop swirling. And then as the coffee starts to lose weight, the moisture starts to be liberated by the heat. It mm-hmm. starts to turn and rotate more, which you want. You don't want the coffee sitting in one spot or else it'll scorch and roast unevenly. And you basically just have to tend to it, especially in the last 30 seconds or so, because coffee's kind of a long warming up process. It turns from green to a golden yellow to a light brown, darker brown, and then you hear the first crack, which is a popping sound, like popcorn, but a little more subtle.
Uh-huh.
And anything from first crack on is ready, depending on your taste. It's ready to drink. Before first crack, it will taste like a cup of grain.
And after first crack, it starts to really taste like coffee.
It's from light roast to dark roast. And that's what light roasting and dark roasting is. It's our French roast is left in longer in the heat source. And what we call city roast or light roast is right after that first crack or first pop ends. That's the point where you have roasted coffee. It's up to you after that. You just invert the popcorn popper into
a basket, a colander mm-hmm. for cooling the coffee, and try to cool it as quickly as you can because coffee's kind of hot mm-hmm. and it keeps roasting itself. So,
is the best cup of coffee going to come from those beans right after they've cooled and then I grind them and make coffee?
It's going to smell incredible. But actually, we like to rest the coffee like overnight, let's say 12 hours, 24 hours is a little bit better.
And the green beans, how do you know which coffees to buy? I look at your site. You sell mm-hmm. all of these green coffee beans. It's a laundry list.
Well, I mean, the coffee flavor that you end up in the cup is a few things combined. It's the origin of the green coffee. And we call those origin flavors. Those mm-hmm. are things that are intrinsic to the coffee because of where it's from and the soil and the altitude and the plant type. We call it cultivar or varietal.
Right.
And then the roasting, what style and technique you've roasted it with. And, of course, related to that is the freshness because if coffee's 2, 3, 4 weeks out of the roaster, it's started to drop off in quality mm-hmm. and it's not going to have very dynamic flavor. So it's a combination of those things. And I think part of the adventure of home roasting is to sort of figure out what you like and do that by trying a little this, trying a little that. If you like really bright, lively coffees, ones that have a kind of a winey character, Kenyas are fantastic coffees for that. They're the sort of king of East African coffees.
Mm-hmm.
Ethiopia are incredibly floral coffees with the wet process Ethiopias. If you like tea.
You'll like Ethiopian coffee?
Yeah, lighter roasts of coffees from southern Ethiopia, Irgachefe area. There's mm-hmm. all these sub-regions. They're beautiful floral jasmine qualities in the coffee. Real classic coffee flavors, good balance of acidity. Which is, acidity sounds like a something bad that burns your stomach, but acidity in coffee is actually kind of like bubbles in soft drink. You know when it's flat and it has no acidity. So you want positive acidity. You don't want to burn your stomach. But Central America's are where you get those really classic balanced coffees between acidity and body and sweetness and some of the grace notes.
Hey, Tom, thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Tom Owen is the creator of Sweet Maria's. Food science can be downright beguiling. It can give you instant success. Food scientists like Harold McGee can banish our fears of failure. And I must add that he can turn tradition on its ear. No old cooking assumption is safe from his experiments. Well, Harold's written Keys to Good Cooking, a guide to making the best of foods and recipes. Harold, welcome back.
Wonderful to be back, Lynn. Thank you.
I want to talk to you about the section of the book that deals with pasta and grains and beans, but specifically pasta. You have a lot of nerve. You talk about cooking pasta in ways that I would say every Italian colleague I know is probably, you know, gunning for you.
Well, it's true. I've been looking over my shoulder the last few months.
I can imagine. All right. Tell us what you found.
Well, this came out of one day cooking pasta the standard way in a big pot of water, which took, you know, 20 minutes to come to a rolling boil. Then I cooked a pound of pasta, which took about 12, 15 minutes.
Right.
And then I poured all that hot water and energy and stuff from the pasta down the drain. And, you know, as my glasses steamed up,
yeah.
I thought, why am I doing this? Why am I spending more time heating the water up than actually cooking the food in it and then pouring all the energy and water down the drain? And I live in California where we think about water, saving water frequently. So I thought, you know, cookbooks say never cook pasta in just a little water because it'll end up gummy and sticky and not very nice. But I wonder if that's true. So I just did the experiment of cooking a pound of pasta in just enough water for it to absorb. And I thought, while I'm at it, why don't I play with the heating as well? I'll start them in cold water and see what happens. And I found that starting in cold water means that the pasta doesn't stick to itself, which is great. And then it turns out that it heats up. It cooks just fine. You end up with pasta that is not at all sticky. The liquid is, I grant, a little thick, but that's wonderful because you can make a sauce out of it. So I recommend cooking a pound of pasta in a quart and a half of cold water in a frying pan. And it takes 15, 20 minutes instead of 45 with the heat up of the water. Works just fine.
I'm one of the few moments I've ever been speechless. All right, I will give this a try. Now, there's something that you mentioned, too, that I liked because it is something, it's an old trick, cooking the pasta in wine and broth or in wine and water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's almost like a risotto version of pasta or a rice version. And, you know, after I published this, I started to hear from people who'd actually traveled to various corners of Italy and said, you know, this is nothing new. People have been doing this kind of thing for a long time. So it's just something that hasn't been as mainstream as the big pot of water technique.
There's an old farmhouse recipe where you would, let's say, brown some celery and carrot and onion and garlic and salami, bits and pieces, essentially, and start the beginning of a sauce. And then you would add the pasta and then you'd add wine and water. And I've always done it with adding a lot of wine and water. But what you're saying makes sense. So you make it like a risotto. You add very little. And it is really a tradition.
Exactly.
It's a really great idea.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Okay, so Harold, you're talking about starting the pasta in cold water. What would happen if you pre-soaked the pasta?
Ah, that's a very good question. And essentially what you do if you pre-soak the pasta is you make dry pasta into fresh pasta. Because, of course, when you make dry pasta, you make pasta fresh,
right,
and then you just dry it. So that works very well. The tricky thing about it is that it is a little time sensitive. So, you know, if you leave it too long, then it does tend to get a little mushy. But if you pre-soak it and then start it in even less water, cold water, then you get a very nice result.
How long would you soak it, more or less?
Oh, maybe 20 minutes, something like that.
Uh-huh. Would you put salt in that water?
Yes, uh-huh, because that's a great way of seasoning the pasta inside and out.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to be drummed out of Italian heritage, but that's okay. You know, it's fine. I'll just say it's because of Harold McGee. Harold, thank you.
A pleasure. Always happy to take the hit for you, Lynn.
Thank you, sir. Harold McGee's latest book is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Now, for a recipe to team with Harold's untraditional pasta cooking techniques, take a look at Fusilli with Shrimp, Chickpeas, and Young Greens. It's on the website, splendidtable.org.
I'm in the phone booth. It's a one across the hall.
Okay, it is time for you and me to talk. The lines are open. Give us a call at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. We have Sarah calling from Jackson, Mississippi. Sarah, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, my question's about stingy glasses of wine that you get at restaurants. My husband and I were at a local restaurant here in Jackson a few weeks ago, and
right,
he ordered a $10 glass of wine, which was frustrating to me from the outset because we've bought this bottle of wine in liquor stores for, you know, $12, but, you know, that's how restaurants do.
Doesn't that hurt?
Yeah, but I mean, I was okay with it. But then when the waiter brought the glass of wine to the table, there was literally about an ounce, maybe an ounce and a half of wine in the glass. And this has happened to us on a couple of occasions, and I don't know the right way to address it with the waiter without looking like a greedy lush.
I'm sorry. This has happened to me as well, and I have a wine-loving pal who does this so gracefully. He has a great sense of humor, you know, and you guys no doubt can handle that brilliantly. But what he'll say to the waiter or waitress is, you know, it says here a glass of wine. And if you'll look here, this is what we call a taste of wine. And, you know, I'm paying $10. And if you don't mind, I'd like to get a real glass of wine. And depending on the size of a glass, you know, generally when you would pour a glass of wine at home, it would probably, the glass would be maybe half full. Right?
Right. Right. Right.
And, you know, in your best of all possible worlds, when you're paying $10, it's 2/3 full. But if you can handle it that way, and if you feel, if the waiter or waitress, you know, the logical thing is if they say, you know, I can't do that, I'm not allowed, just ask in a nice way, say, you know, I'd really love to talk to your manager, and I'm not going to get you in trouble. It's not your problem. And tell the manager. And if the manager doesn't, you know, decide to give you what you want, you could kind of very nicely make it clear, you know what, this is not making our meal any more pleasant, and we don't go out that often, and we want to enjoy it, and, you know, we're going to have our dinner, but I don't know if we're going to be back. Now, that's pretty, I don't know how you feel about that, but I think that really gets a message across.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I mean, I should know, like, how to do it, but I think, like you say, approaching it with a little bit of humor.
A little bit of humor, and, you know, you're not really, you know, angry, but if they don't try to accommodate you, because what you're asking for is not unreasonable at all. And, you know, if you're going to charge a lot of money for a glass of wine, you should have a glass of wine.
Right.
That's it.
I think so, too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right.
I hope that works, dear, because he handles it so nicely, this pal of mine, I have to tell you.
Well, it sounds great. Thanks so much for taking my call. I love your show.
Well, thank you, ma'am. You take care.
All right. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back to you in a moment, so get in touch. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Pick up that phone. Call us at 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, let's get back to you. You can go to the phones, 800-537-5252, or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Connect with us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We've got Alan calling from New York City. Alan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am swell. How about you?
Great. I am what I like to call a reformed omnivore. I used to eat just about anything,
yeah,
any animal, any part of any animal. And over the past few years, you know, somewhat to my wife's dismay, I've begun to move towards the observance of the laws of kashrut, the Jewish dietary.
Right,
laws, okay? And, you know, there's a lot of things that I miss, but I've learned to do without. But there are some things that I really, really, really miss. And in particular, I miss the sort of umami explosion that happens when a good Parmesan or Grana Padano comes up against, you know, a meat broth or a meat sauce or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just sort of like two examples that stick out in my mind. One is I used to make this sort of lamb ragu of a shredded sort of lamb shank and serve it with some cheese on pasta.
Right.
And it was
right.
Just wonderful. Another thing that sticks out in my memory is when my wife and I were in Rome in 1985, we had a risotto al barolo, you know, just a cheese risotto with the juices of a pot roast in Barolo wine sauce.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It was just not like nothing I've ever eaten. And, you know, under kashrut, you can't mix milk and meat. It's sort of fundamental. And I don't know what to do.
Okay. The umami mention, you know, this fifth taste that lifts all boats, you know, you add certain things that have a lot of umami in them, which is this protein, to things, and they make everything else taste better. And Parmigiano Reggiano is one of the first on the list.
Right.
But so is tomato paste.
Uh-huh.
So are dark mushrooms, dried mushrooms.
Uh-huh.
So is fish sauce.
Okay.
So this is what I'm wondering. You can't do the Parmigiano in a meat broth, but what if you were to make yourself a really, really delicious vegetable broth?
Uh-huh.
Where you took slices of onion, okay,
right,
and carrot and celery, and I mean, there are meat broth recipes all over the place. I think vegetable broth recipes all over the place.
Right.
I know we've got some on the website.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. If you brown those things, you lightly oil them with olive oil, very lightly, and you put them in the oven under the broiler.
Mm-hmm.
Then you put them into the pot with some white wine, and you let them simmer.
Mm-hmm.
And usually vegetable broth doesn't take as long. Now, you no longer have the meat problem.
Right.
And you've got a really delicious broth. Now the Parmigiano can go on it.
Right.
Now you can make a wonderful risotto with that.
Right.
It's not going to be the Barolo, but you could have red wine in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to be the one with the meat juices, but I have to tell you, risotto made with red wine and a good vegetable broth, really fabulous. Just make the wine a kicker.
Now, what about the other problem, which is when you have a sauce with meat in it or when you want to put something in meatballs? Now, with this lamb ragu, I did try once making like a duxelle with mushrooms and anchovies and some breadcrumbs and cooked it down till it was crumbly.
How was it?
Well, you know, I could eat it with a spoon, but it wasn't the same.
It's not, you know what, sometimes you can't do the same.
Yeah.
But what you can do is really, really as good.
Okay.
Because one of the things I was thinking about in that case would be to use some dried porcini mushrooms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, and those you would lightly sauté, and they could go over the top as you're tossing. The other thing is, and again, this isn't the same, but it gives you an interesting finish. There's a great tradition, and you find it in a lot of parts of Italy, which is called poor man's Parmigiano.
Right.
Because it was expensive. People couldn't afford
it. Right.
And what you do is you take fresh breadcrumbs.
Right.
And you sauté them until they're crunchy and crisp.
Right.
And they can be coarse ground in the processor.
Right.
With garlic and olive oil.
Uh-huh.
And when you do that ragu, right?
Right.
Or when you just do a tomato sauce, however you want to do your pasta,
mm-hmm.
this gets sprinkled over the top at the last minute. And you get this wonderful, flavorful kind of crunch. And the oil is flavorful. It is so good.
That sounds great. I think what I will do is put some of maybe the dried mushrooms in the sauce and have these crunchy garlic breadcrumbs on top.
You are going to, if you'll pardon me, plots.
Okay, it sounds wonderful.
You are going to love this.
It sounds fabulous.
Hey,
I'll give it a try.
None of this is going to taste bad. I promise you.
Right. Okay. Hey, thank you so much.
Hey, Alan, thank you.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Call us, 800-537-5252. Pandeya, who's in Newton, Kansas, has a great question. And it's one of those things, you know, everybody wonders about, but you don't ask it. She says, almost every baking recipe says to use the middle rack of the oven, but every oven she's ever used has four positions for the rack. So there's no middle. So which one should she use? This is what I've always done. I use the second rack from the bottom, and that usually places whatever I'm baking more or less in the middle. So not to be too picky, but use the second rack from the bottom. You'll get great air circulation and heat circulation around whatever you're doing, which is the point of the whole deal. And thanks for a great question. You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Christine is on the line from Culver City, California. Christina, hi.
Hi.
What is on your mind, ma'am?
A couple months ago, my husband and I started having dinners with some friends, and it started with a conversation about Indian food, and we decided to do an Indian food dinner.
Right.
And that was fun, so it's kind of started into an ongoing thing.
Like cooking club sort of thing.
Kind of like a cooking club, but so far it's just two couples.
Right.
So it's not that many people cooking, but all four of us cook, so it's actually four people cooking. But since our next dinner is going to be coming up soon, midwinter, we thought we'd do a cold country to choose as our theme for our next dinner.
Right.
So we chose Russia. And the problem is I've never cooked Russian food. The only Russian food I think I've ever eaten is borscht. And I don't know of any authors. So I was wondering if you had any recommendations for cookbooks.
Let me count the way. Well, there aren't. I can't off the top of my head. I can only think of two off the top of my head. But one of them has done two books, and she's a scholar as well as a food writer. And the other one is deeply knowledgeable. Anya von Bremsen, who was born and raised in Russia, did a book called Please to the Table. And it's an older book, but you'll find it online. And then Dara Goldstein did two books. And one is, I want to say it's the Winter Larder. It's something with winter in the title, and it's on our website. And this is about the food of winter, and mainly it's Russian food. And the intro that she does is one of the most wonderfully written salutes to the glories of cold weather food I've ever read. Now, none of these are new books, but they are out there. If you look for Dara Goldstein, you're going to find them, and Anya von Bremsen. And one of the fun things that you can do is a zakuski table. And this is really the predecessor to the hors d'oeuvre, or the concept, the Russian concept of the hors d'oeuvre. You know, in the days when people used to drive across vast areas of snow and the ice cold, and if you could imagine them in sleighs being pulled by horses, and they would go for a week or a weekend at some friend's country house, often they'd be greeted when they came in the door by a vast table of all kinds of snacks, pickled seafood and wonderful hors d'oeuvre and pâtés and cold vodka and that kind of thing. And you can have a blast with this. You know, I mean, you could just do a zakuski table and stop there.
Yeah.
So anyway, check out those two authors. They're going to really give you a great start.
Oh, great.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
And it's a great idea. You're making me hungry.
Well, so far it's been a lot of fun.
Now, I don't know how this is going to fly in Culver City, but I have to tell you, in Minnesota, we're right on it.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's not exactly cold in winter in Culver City.
Well, you're welcome to come here and celebrate if you want to. Hey, Christina, thanks for a great question.
Oh, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Reach us 800-537-5252. We've got Bill calling from Florence, Alabama. Bill, hi. What can we do for you today?
I need help substituting mascarpone in tiramisu. I can't always find mascarpone in the grocery store.
Ah, I've got the substitute for you.
Well, I do see something called Mexican table cream.
That's going to be a little soft. Because mascarpone, you know, is pretty firm. It's quite thick. It's very dense.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, what I do is I blend up cream cheese in a processor or whatever with heavy cream or sour cream. And it's pretty thick. You know, the idea is it's mainly cream cheese, but you want to have more butter fat. So that's why you use the sour cream or the whipping cream, you know, the heavy cream. And that's it. And it's going to be a good stand-in.
All right. Have you ever tried to make your own with tartaric acid?
I have. And it works out fairly well. But if you're really in a hurry, this is going to be your answer.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm always in favor of making fresh cheeses. I adore them. Absolutely love them. But this is going to work for you as well.
All right.
Hey, you're all set.
Excellent. You're great.
Well, thank you. You're not so bad yourself, Bill.
You're quite welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook. Or actually send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Well, the glories of mid-century modern and retro style. You know, the days when moms cooked dinner in frilly aprons and heels, and dads always sat down at the table in suits and ties, and the kids raised their hands to speak. Well, this is the culinary era that James Oliver Curry collects, and in a rather unusual way. James, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So what is this collection?
What is it? I have collected records, vinyl, LPs, and 33s and 45s for several decades now, and I've focused on food and drink-themed records for probably the last 20 years.
Now, are these records with music, you know, to eat dinner by, or are these, you know, how-tos and that kind of thing?
You know, I have organized it in so many different categories. There's a million different ways you can slice and dice it. Fundamentally, you can have records that are advertising jingles, or you can have records that are instructional, like the how-to that you mentioned. You can also have records that just take either a popular cuisine of the time, whether it's Italian food or Chinese food, particularly in the late 50s and 60s, and really just pair very bizarre, easy-listening instrumentals to a concept in a way that almost makes no sense.
For instance.
Well, there are several pizza party records that I have, so that's a huge genre or subgenre within itself. But one of the records that I have is essentially a promotional LP for a company called Geno's Pizza, but they have a band called the Accordionaires, and there's nothing particularly Italian about the songs or about the song titles, so it's really just music to have a pizza party to, and yet the music, it's a total disconnect. And that's one of the curiosities to me is, why was pizza so interesting, and who was buying a record about a pizza party anyway?
And it sounds like, you know, early product placement. It was an ad. It was an ad,
yes,
essentially, for this company and this particular band.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so some of these records were available to the public at record stores. Some of them were undoubtedly just sent to radio producers or handed out at conventions so that somebody would play it on the air.
There's one I see here, because I see there are illustrations of part of your collection.
Yeah.
Here, and this looks like that family I described. Mom is in the frilly apron. There's candles on the table. Dad's in his suit and tie. But it's called Here, How to Plan the Perfect Dinner Party.
Yep. It's funny. There's a lot of Norman Rockwell-esque moments on the covers of these albums.
Right.
So I get an insight into what someone's view of Americana is, whether that's an actual depiction, and whether it's the romanticization of the suburbs, or whether it has to do with some sort of other post-war cultural shift. This is an interesting record, How to Plan the Perfect Dinner Party, because it came out in 1960, and you know that's about a year, I think, before we saw Julia Child's masterpiece, and yet we know that there was lots of books coming out that were trying to help people cook and entertain. And this really is a guide to how to cook four different deluxe dinners. And the interesting thing for me here is also what they chose to focus on. So they have a French dinner menu, a Polynesian dinner menu, a chicken dinner, and a steak dinner. And so, you know, you get a sense that the Polynesian speaks to the tiki interest of the time.
Right,
and
right.
The French is certainly considered to be the gourmet upscale dinner. Steak being probably very Americana, meat and potatoes, and
yeah,
then chicken being almost like the safety that we have today, chicken being one of the most popular words you'll find on recipe searches in general.
Were there any big musical names that are in the collection? Were there any people,
yes,
who we would recognize today?
Well, the funny thing is that several jazz greats recorded either songs or whole albums that somehow were dedicated to food. And I'm as interested in just cover imagery as I am in the content on the album. So it could be that there was just a popular song called Popcorn or Salt Peanuts, and a million different artists took that song and put that on their cover of their album in a very either ludicrous or kind of sexy way that would make no sense today in today's markets.
Right.
An album I have that's Super Sax Plays Bird, referring to Charlie Parker. And the two women on the cover of the album are naked, holding saxophones, and sitting on a giant mound of peanuts. So what you get actually are some jazz guys playing Charlie Parker songs, including Salt Peanuts, but the cover is totally exploiting the idea of yeah. both food and women on it in a way that just makes you, it takes your breath away almost, or at least it makes you scratch your head and laugh at the same time.
Right. So how many albums have you got?
Well, in the food realm alone, I probably have somewhere between 150 and 200 albums. You know, this is part of a collection that has about 5,000 records total in different categories. It's constantly growing. I'm always searching on eBay or whenever I'm in a record shop, which are fewer and fewer these days. And the good thing for a collector of this genre is that there aren't that many other people competing for this particular niche.
Well, James, thanks for talking with us and opening up a whole new area of collecting and maybe cooking as well. Thank you. James Oliver Curry collects culinary vinyl. Well, that's our show this week. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, I have become more optimistic and now believe that things could get worse. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to splendidtable.org to find information on anything you heard here this week. Get registered for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, subscribe to our weekly podcasts, and rifle through our collection of recipes. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Alexandra Baumhart. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM.